Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Hey, Paul, I burnt my pizza today.
Tell me more, Matt.
Yeah, it was a Hawaiian pizza, Paul. So I think I should have cooked it at aloha temperature.
That is truly awful, and you should be filled with shame.
You know, I mean, puns are...
I'm not.
Yeah, you know, puns are often bad, but I enjoy them, Paul. I think secretly you do as well, and we can all agree to that. Paul, let's get to the show.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician. His mom tattoos that on his underwear, sews that in his underwear. Paul, is that
you want to take that one again?
Nope, I'm going to let it stand. I'm just bombing the whole intro. And if the audience can't tell, we haven't recorded in probably a month. And we're just, you know, working the kinks out.
We're easing into it.
Paul, how you doing?
I'm good, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's hot cakes. I'm bombing. And but we have two great co-hosts, and I'll let you introduce the show and tell everyone who they are and what we're going to do tonight.
Sure, Matt. So I'll remind our audience, as we are generally the internal medicine podcast, and we typically use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. But tonight, this is one of our renowned Hot Cakes episodes where we review current literature for you, the listener, and let you know how we thought about it, what we thought about it, whether it is actionable stuff. And Matt, we are joined, of course, by two elite veteran members of the Curbsiders team, our resident epidemiologist, Dr. Rahul Ganatra, and freshly minted official hematologist, hematologist, oncologist? How would you like to be referred to, Dr. Toronto?
Actually, just oncologist. It's
I don't get to call you
out,
hematologist?
No.
I cannot believe I've been texting you for the past 2 years, general hematology questions. This is a debacle. But great to see you both.
Nice to see you too.
And Nora, Dr. Toronto, specializing in breast cancer, is that correct?
Exactly.
All right. Well, congratulations. I live close enough that I can refer you patients, so I will...
Yes.
I will do my best to send them your way.
Clinic opening soon.
Okay. Well, we have a lot to get to. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And to start us off, who better to do that than Nora herself? And Nora, tell me, I have a huge CBD habit and... but I also really care about my liver. So do I have anything to worry about?
It's a great question, Matt. There was just a study published in JAMA Internal Medicine this last July by Florian et al. And this study was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial that looked at what the effect of CBD was in intermediate-range dosing, which is the dosing that's often used or thought to be used in these over-the-counter products on liver enzyme and liver function tests and endocrine hormones. And this is important because there is one FDA-approved CBD product that's actually used to treat seizures, but there are a lot of unregulated products that contain CBD, the non-psychoactive component of cannabis, within them. And it's unclear what dosing patients and individuals taking these products are actually using, but it's thought that some relatively substantial percent of the population is actually taking doses in this intermediate range, not in the low range, not in the high range, and we don't know what the effect on liver function is. And so the top line results in this study, where this was a positive study, this study compared CBD, and they used the FDA-approved drug as the CBD product in healthy individuals, and compared that product given twice daily over 28 days to healthy individuals to placebo, given along the same schedule. And this study did demonstrate that there were increased elevated liver enzymes in more patients who were receiving CBD than placebo.
Yeah. And so this was like the, if you had your standard, let's just for easy math, 100 kilogram person, that so they were taking 500 milligrams a day or around that, 500 or less milligrams a day.
Yeah, and it was split dosing, not that this matters particularly, but really just because there's uncertainty about kind of how patients are actually taking these products, people can take them more than one time a day. So it was 2.5 milligrams per kilogram per day, twice daily.
Yeah.
And so, that's significantly lower than the dosing for the CBD product for epilepsy. That dosing is, I think, around 25 milligrams per kilogram daily, though I might be misremembering that. But and that dosing was associated in clinical trials with elevated risk of having liver enzyme increases as well.
So essentially here we're talking about, is there a drug-induced liver injury of some sort from this dose of CBD? And it seems like there was in this population. I mean, what struck me about this was just these were relatively younger, like 18 to 55 years old, right? And they had pretty extensive exclusion criteria. So these were not people that were drinking heavy alcohol. They weren't using other substances. Their liver tests pretty much had to be normal at baseline. So I just feel like this was, and these people, am I correct? They weren't taking medications like within like 2 weeks before. So these are people that weren't really on other meds, I guess, just to make sure you could cleanly say that CBD was the substance that was probably causing the liver changes, liver tests elevation. But, you know, to me, it's a pretty highly selected population. And in my experience, the kind of people that I'm seeing, like, everyone has lots of medical problems and may or may not use substances, and they're using CBD. So it was a little alarming to me that you saw this result even in a healthy population.
Mm-hmm. And so they followed patients for a short period of time after the 28 days of administration, but they didn't actually follow patients super long term on the CBD product. And so we really don't know a ton about both the natural history of liver function changes on CBD more chronically. We also don't know kind of is the natural trajectory that this actually would have gone up and then come back down to a normal range for patients, though I suspect not based on the timing of it.
Yeah. Is it like the creatinine bump you see when you start an SGLT2 inhibitor that we just kind of ignore and don't check labs during that time? Rahul, so you mentioned like my point about this being a healthy population. Does that lower your confidence in the result or increase your confidence in the result? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. How could you tell I was chomping at the bit to talk about this? I mean, just putting the results in context, like this was 8 patients, 5% of the CBD group compared with 0 patients, a flat 0% in the control group. And usually when we're talking about appraising randomized controlled trials of therapeutics, you know, a highly selected patient population is usually a bad thing for generalizability. I mean, you know, if you show that a drug works in a Goldilocks perfect population, you always wonder how will that translate to the real world. But in my mind, when the outcome of interest is an adverse event, then I think things are a little flipped on their head. I think it makes sense to sort of, you know, really try to isolate the adverse effect that we're talking about. And they made other analytic decisions in line with that. They used a per protocol analysis in contrast to an intention to treat analysis, which would tend to underestimate the frequency of adverse events. So it's an important learning point when, you know, the outcome of interest is an adverse event. If you do a pragmatic trial with an intention to treat analysis, those are going to tend to underestimate adverse effects. Whereas if you do a healthy patient population where, you know, the results might not generalize to the patients that we're caring for on face value, but we can feel much more confident in the causal effect of the adverse effect here. So to me, this is great. This is a home run.
Before we go back to you for other limitations and stuff, Paul, the great Dr. Williams, any comments?
No, I think that's exactly, like, this is a nice clean trial, which is great. And I think just to put it in the context of real world, like there's an editorial that I think it says like 20% of Americans have used some kind of CBD product in the past for some health care, like some huge number. And I will say that these products are not cheap. They are, I think, sometimes used as sort of like a last resort when other stuff's not working. So to your point, Matt, these are, you know, often used by multimorbid patients already on a number of medications that may or may not have hepatotoxicity. So I think in this healthy patient population with sort of baseline normal labs who are not sensibly using other substances, like the fact that this effect was still seen, I think, yeah, you have to extrapolate that to the real world population is kind of alarming. And I think it does change how I might ask more about this if I do sort of see changes in like liver function, that kind of stuff. So I think it's a great trial as far as I can tell.
Yeah, Nora, any other limitations or any other things about the study you want to point out before we get to the your hotcakes rating?
No, I mean, I think the main limitation with it is really what I mentioned before, which is the duration of exposure and the duration of follow-up, which I think limits a little bit what we're able to extract from it. But I agree that I think it actually is a really it covered a really interesting problem in a useful way, and actually I think gives answers to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should definitely hear more about this in longer, you know, following people out longer that are using it and just try to see how, is this just like a bunch of nothing? Like it just causes transient elevations that just don't cause any hard outcomes that we care about? Or does it like accelerate, you know, steatotic liver disease and cirrhosis and all that?
Yeah, and I do think it is going to reframe how I'm asking patients about, because I ask patients about supplements generally, but I don't know that I've ever been like directly asking them about using CBD. And so I think this actually may change my practice in doing that.
One ill-formed question I have is just going through, noticing the adverse events specifically. In the control group, there was an insomnia event rate of 27%, which I just found fascinating. Yeah. I just wonder what it says about sort of the folks who are actually recruited. Like, I just don't know what to do with that information, but it just seems weird. And I feel like it seems noteworthy. Yeah. And I'm still kind of chewing on it because it feels like it's important, but I can't tell you exactly why or how that might actually happen.
My one thought I had was that it might be related to what Rahul had pointed out about the like bizarre, I guess for pharmacologic studies, they often will do this, but patients stayed overnight for several nights of the study. And so I don't know exactly when they were capturing those adverse events, but I do kind of wonder whether just like disruption of...
Or the CBD patients slept better.
Like, yeah. Well, they were more drowsy, right? Yeah. They had more somnolence. So,
right. So like that might actually be seeing a treatment effect here as opposed to an adverse effect in the control group.
Yeah. And that could also be reflective of like, who is going to be interested in enrolling in a study of CBD?
Exactly.
It might be people with things that they wonder if might be improved by CBD.
Yeah.
But yeah, the sleepaway camp for the study was a surprise. I don't know why that was necessary.
I somehow missed that. I can see the excitement for being recruited. That sounds great.
Yep.
Nora, so how many hotcakes for this one?
I'm going to upstage my hotcakes.
I'm gonna add an extra hotcake.
Yeah. I feel really positive about, even more positive than I was going into this talking to you all. So I'm going like 4.5.
It's like stage 4 hotcake. You know? Yeah.
Stage 4. No, the opposite of stage 4 hotcakes.
Okay. Well, we are going to move on to our next one. And we recently had an iron deficiency episode with the great Dr. Tom DeLore. And I do have a comment from him about this trial we're about to talk about. This was an IV iron in heart failure trial. And before we get to the details of the study, Paul, this was the FAIR-HF2 trial. And then they also have this random number DZHK05 in there as well.
Great.
I tried to look up where that's coming from, and the FAIR H2F, it says it stands for intravenous iron in patients with systolic heart failure and iron deficiency to improve morbidity and mortality. So, Paul, where do you get FAIR HF2 from that?
You don't, and it starts with an if. Like, you can make something work. Like, you don't have to force the if. It's just, it's shameful. It's shameful. I mean, strong work by the authors in everything but the study name. But yeah, it's grotesque. I'm sorry to say.
This episode is brought to you by the Permanente Medical Group. Are you a primary care physician ready for a new change of pace? The Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, is calling your name. Experience the flexibility of a 4 or 5 day work week with hybrid practice options and a schedule that works for your life. Join our multidisciplinary practice and provide patient care without the headaches of overhead billing or RVUs. You know you don't want to deal with that stuff. The benefits? Our competitive salary and benefits package includes competitive compensation, Northern California home buying assistance, moving and relocation allowance, comprehensive insurance, 3 retirement plans, including a pension, and if you have student loans, we're PSLF eligible. From breathtaking natural surroundings to vibrant cities, we have locations throughout Northern and Central California that you'll love to call home. If you want to join thousands of physicians who've made TPMG their career destination, discover more at northerncalifornia.permanente.org. Again, that's northerncalifornia.permanente.org. And so this was a study by Anker et al., who publishes a lot on this topic. And this was in JAMA and appeared in June 2025. And really the question is, does this high dose, and they were using ferric carboxymaltose, Paul, that's the hypophosphatemia one, just for those who are keeping track. Does this improve hard clinical outcomes in ambulatory patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction? Because there has been uncertainty about this. There's been some trials that say maybe it's good for heart failure. Some trials say, well, it improves quality of life and function, but not necessarily, it doesn't reduce mortality or cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization. So this was seeking to answer that. And that's kind of the background here. It's in the guidelines right now with the recommendations. It's not like a 1A. I think it might be a 2A or 2B recommendation in the heart failure guidelines for giving IV iron to patients. So the top line results, this was a negative trial. Ferric carboxymaltose did not significantly reduce the risk of cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization compared to placebo, even in the group with a transferrin saturation less than 20%. So I will pause there, and I wanted to go to Rahul for comment, because Rahul, they changed the primary outcome during this because they were recruiting and doing the study during the COVID-19 pandemic. So can you talk a little bit about what was so unique about the way that they handled this, and if you thought it was good science or bad science the way they did it?
Yeah. So this is a study where if you just read the abstract, you were skimming through, you were looking to, you know, just quickly like walking on your way to Journal Club about this paper, looking to see what the results were, you might see this result in there for one of the three primary outcomes that was a hazard ratio of 0.79 with a confidence interval that didn't include one and a p-value of 0.04. So you might look at that and think, okay, great. Looks like this IV iron reduced this component of the primary outcome.
And that was the cardiovascular death or first hospitalization for heart failure.
Exactly. So, but the authors conclude their top line findings that this was a negative study. So what gives? So Matt, as you mentioned, the primary outcome in this study was changed from looking at one outcome that was a composite of several things to looking at three primary outcomes. Okay. And they provide some justification for that in a separate paper, which frankly, I didn't read. I accept their reasoning that there were reasons to do this. Okay. So without evaluating those reasons, what are the implications of going from making one test or one comparison to making three? Well, we all know that the more tests you do, the more likely you are to get a false positive finding just due to chance alone, right? I mean, we've all heard the adage that if you have 20 secondary outcomes at a p-value of 0.05, chances are one of them is going to be significant. So that's basically what is the risk here. And to control that risk, the authors used a procedure that, Matt, we were talking about a little bit before we record, so I don't want to steal all your thunder with this, but this Hochberg procedure.
No, you steal. I wanted you to talk about this. I'm not qualified.
Okay, well, so the Hochberg procedure, basically, my lay understanding of this, okay, is that the problem that this is meant to address is if you do more comparisons, your likelihood of finding a positive result due to chance goes up. Okay. So what the Hochberg procedure does is it applies a more stringent p-value criteria, okay, to different combinations of the outcome. So we're used to seeing, you know, one test and doing a p-value of 0.05 for that. People might have seen, the Bonferroni method used in other papers. That's basically using a more stringent p-value in the setting of multiple comparisons. The reason why this is thought to be a good way to deal with this is slightly technical and not really relevant to our appraisal of the results. Yeah. What people need to know is that when you go from having a primary outcome that is one outcome to looking at three things, you need some way to account for the fact that you have just increased your likelihood of a false finding by chance. And that's what the Hochberg procedure does.
Yeah. And I thought that this is something that I guess I had not heard of before. So I thought it was kind of neat. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to cover this.
It's pretty
cool. Essentially, this sort of leaves us where we're like, was it something about this study that made it that it was a negative trial? Reading editorials and reading the author's appraisal of this, they're not ready to put this to rest, that like they still believe IV iron does improve not just symptoms in heart failure, but also heart failure hospitalizations and maybe death if you select the population correctly. And they were suggesting maybe if you do a trial in the right patients with iron saturation less than 20% and you give them IV iron, maybe those patients will benefit. So I don't know, Paul and Nora, any other thoughts or comments on this study?
I mean, the only additional comment that I have is it relates to what you just said, which is that I still have this feeling, though not proven by any means, that there's some subgroup in here that we may be missing a benefit in, just based on the kind of different inclusion criteria that patients could meet. Some patients were being discharged from the hospital. Some patients had an elevated BNP, and some patients had a heart failure hospitalization within 12 months. So I think those even just by themselves feel like really distinct subgroups of heart failure patients.
Yeah, I also, we're talking about, Matt, you're saying the investigators, people are kind of not really ready to put this to bed. I mean, it's in the guidelines to give people iron. And so how could this have been a false negative finding, I think, is kind of a relevant question. Like, are there sources of chance or bias that could have made it so that we didn't find an association between IV iron and these outcomes that is there? So the trial was powered to find a 30% or greater relative reduction, and the point estimates were smaller than that. They were all about 20% relative reduction. So, you could make the argument that, well, was the study underpowered? There was a large proportion of patients dropping out from both groups. It was like a third of patients in both groups. And the amount of variability in the data was higher than expected. They talk about the over-dispersion parameter, which I'm sure everyone loves to get into the weeds of.
Oh, fine, Rahul. Yeah, that was named by my post-hardcore band in college. Fine, I'll do it. Great.
Yeah. Go ahead. All that is to say is that there were some sources of, bias towards a negative study. Yeah. So it's hard to make a conclusion. We need some subject matter expertise about what to do here.
I did reach out to the great Tom DeLore about this, and if you ever have the pleasure of emailing him, number one, he will send you pictures from the latest place that he did some wilderness medicine or just was hiking, and he sent me these beautiful photos of Denali National Park. And then his email signature says sent via tin can and string, which I just love, instead of, you know, sent from my iPhone. And he said, I said, Tom, what do you make of this? Like, do you think IV iron works for heart failure? And he said, good question. My take on the iron trials is there seems to be benefit with many, but not all trials showing improvement in 6-minute walk time, et cetera, but not a clear home run. And he said one of his issues is, why are they using ferric carboxymaltose? Because with the hypophosphatemia that some people can get, that can actually like blunt your positive results, because some people are going to get hypophosphatemia and feel bad from that. So that's not a great thing for quality of life. So I don't know. He said he does screen patients, and he's still following the heart failure guidelines, which say, you know, if you find it in someone with HFrEF that you can treat it. So I think maybe future trials, they could try different IV irons, and maybe they're going to target different populations. So overall, I give this like 3.5 hotcakes. I thought, you know, I'm just a sucker for iron deficiency anemia, IV iron. I like reading about it. And I thought that this was, you know, I like the statistics that they did in this one. I learned something there. So I'm giving it 3.5 hotcakes. Probably not practice changing. I'll probably continue to liberally give IV iron if I think a patient could benefit from it. If no other comments, then I think we are ready for Rahul. This is a, you know, Paul and I fight about this a lot, this timing of blood pressure medications. Paul is pretty militant. He makes all his patients take it exactly like 1 hour before bedtime. Is that true, Paul?
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially diuretics. Yeah, I demand.
And diuretics. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. When we were in residency, Paul would go around the hospital and dose diuretics at like bedtime just to...
Everyone's,
you know,
favorite.
Yeah, and then check that 3 a.m. potassium just to make sure doing okay.
So Rahul, bedtime administration of blood pressure medications, this doesn't have any kind of fraught background, does it? And can you tell us why you chose this?
Oh, man. Well, it does have a fraught background, Matt, since you asked. And I think we found the trial to finally put this issue to bed.
Nice.
Just an audible groan from Paul.
Paul did not like it.
I have been waiting for 30 minutes to say that. So, okay. So, Matt, you asked about the history of this question. And, you know, it seems like at its face, kind of a, you know, simple question. Is it better to take antihypertensives at bedtime or in the morning upon waking? There's a theoretical benefit to taking blood pressure medicines at night. We know that a nocturnal dipping of blood pressure is something that is seen in healthy individuals, and the loss of nocturnal dipping is associated with cardiovascular adverse outcomes. So the hypothesis that, you know, has led to this is it better to try to sort of, you know, restore the normal circadian rhythm of blood pressure changes with nighttime dosing. Now, apparently there's also a theoretical harm of nighttime dosing, which I was not aware of, but I don't know if it's because I am not, you know, the person caring for patients and prescribing eye drops for glaucoma, but it's, you know, could patients with glaucoma experience ischemic optic neuropathy? Those of you who do outpatient medicine, I'm wondering if that's a thing.
I'm ashamed to say it, but this was not on my radar.
Hmm.
Yeah, I stand in solidarity with you, Matt.
Yeah. So I was willy-nilly just telling people to take your blood pressure medicines whenever you want. But so that's the background. And there was two big trials from a single group of investigators in Spain that have been published over the past several years that suggested that nighttime dosing was associated with really large, and we're talking like 40% to 60% reductions in MACE simply from taking antihypertensives at night. So those findings really have not been able to be replicated, and so there's a lot of controversy in the hypertension community about if this is a real benefit or not. So enter the BedMed trial, okay? This trial was designed to answer this question once and for all. Is taking blood pressure medicines at bedtime better than taking them in the morning for cardiovascular risk reduction? And so, you know, before we get into the conduct of the study, I'm going to tell you the top line findings, and we can go into it from there. This was a negative trial, okay, Matt, over a median follow-up of just over 4.5 years among patients randomized to take their antihypertensives in the morning versus at night. The rate of all-cause death or hospitalization for stroke, MI, or congestive heart failure per 100 patient years was 2.3 in the bedtime group versus 2.4 in the morning group. Okay, so those were not different, and that was a hazard ratio of very close to one. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the details, but I'm curious, are there any questions people have up front about how the question was asked, how this was answered?
I have one unrelated, well, slightly related question to the optic neuropathy thing. Paul, true or false, will you refill any glaucoma medication that a patient calls and asks for?
I'm just going to decline to answer that, Matt, but I tend to be fairly generous with eye drops if someone's having a hard time getting hold of their eye doctor. Else, why don't we frame it that way?
I will back you up on that, Paul. If someone asks me for refills of their, like, you know, latanoprost eye drops, I'm probably going to refill it on, you know, as long as they've seen an eye doctor at least once in the past 10 years.
Yeah, as long as it came from them at one point. Yeah. No, it's a fair,
I won't start it, but I will refill it. Yeah. Mm. Okay. But yeah, this trial, Rahul, one thing that I noticed, this trial was stopped early, and that's always, to me, just, you know, I just want your take on that, how much you think that might have affected this being a negative trial. They said it was due to funding constraints, I believe.
Yeah. So, I mean, excellent question. It's always important to evaluate the impact of unexpected trial termination on the results. So I'll give you a little more detail. This was an open label pragmatic trial that was done in five provinces in Canada. Okay. And they approached about 400 primary care clinicians to do recruitment among their patient panels. And they recruited patients through direct mailing, word of mouth, and a social media campaign, which consisted of a YouTube video, which is just delightful. We can include a link to that.
Oh, man, I should have watched it.
Oh, yeah. It made me want to participate in the study. Then they randomized patients one-to-one just to take whatever blood pressure medicines they were on, okay? And patients had to be taking at least one once-daily medicine. They could be taking more, and they could be taking BID, TID meds if needed, just while preparing for bed or upon waking. And the follow-up in this study was all by telephone or email, and they did do 24-hour ABPM in a small subset of patients. And so, you know, who was in the study? It was 3,300 community-dwelling adults. The mean age was in the older 60s. In my view, this was a relatively kind of healthy, active, doing well community-dwelling population. 20% had diabetes, 10% had known coronary disease, but, you know, they were exercising a median of 3 days a week, which is pretty good. The population was relatively homogenous, this being done in Canada. So, yeah, I mean, I can tell you my sort of take on this overall, but, you know, I'm curious if people have any, you know, concerns or thoughts, you know, related to the study population and the potential for stopping early. I realize I haven't really answered your question, Matt, but it was stopped early because they basically ran out of money. And, you know, the consequence of stopping early due to financial constraints is if you accrue fewer than expected primary outcome events, is that a source of bias towards a false negative finding? So could there have been a benefit here that we missed because the study stopped early? I'm curious if anybody has opinions on that.
Yeah, I mean, you found a difference in sprint trial in, I think it was 3.5 years, and they had 4.5 years follow-up. I mean, it seems, I guess this was this population, I'm trying to remember how old the average patients were in this, Rahul, were they?
Upper 60s.
Yeah. So, I mean, I mean, in that population, I feel like patients over 50, you know, almost 4.5 years follow-up, I think you could probably detect a difference there, even if it stopped early. But I don't know. Nora, what do you think?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I feel like they did a pretty good job. I'm just reminding myself of kind of doing various sensitivity analyses to try to make sure that there weren't substantially different effects in, you know, by the type of by whether a patient was on a diuretic or not a diuretic, whether a patient, a variety of other clinical factors, which makes me think makes me agree with you that I think this is more robust, even though the study did stop early. And yeah, and then also just the only other kind of question related to that to some extent is just kind of how you reconcile and whether this also kind of biases towards a null finding. The fact that more patients were, I think, not adherent at 6 months in the bedtime arm than in the morning arm. And that, I mean, that may be clinically relevant information to actually think about in thinking about patient preference, but kind of how that would affect the results as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the fact that the point estimates were like basically identical between the two groups, to me, that's reassuring. There was a companion trial done among kind of frail elderly patients in Canada that was done in parallel with this. And that study also showed no benefit of nighttime dosing in, you know, a sort of higher risk, more frail population. And, you know, this study was powered to detect a 25% or greater relative reduction, which is a smaller difference than what was seen in the MAPEC and Hygieia trials that kind of led to the controversy here.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do we
even detect that?
Exactly. So, I mean, that all of that taken together kind of increases my confidence that there's probably no large benefit to taking medications at night. Now, it seems like it's safe. You know, there was not a difference in adverse events between the two groups, and they looked at adverse events related to falls, orthostasis, you know, cognitive deterioration, quality of life, range of things, and there was really no signal for harm. The amount of loss to follow-up is relatively small in this study.
It's odd that the median age was 67, right? Like, because they were recruiting over the age of 18, like this, and this is a population that just sort of skewed awfully old if that was when you started recruitment. Like, I don't quite know what to do with that, if anything. But I just, it's weird. So, and I don't know that it has necessarily biases anything, but on the other hand, like as a median age for someone where you start at age 18 and then go all the way to death. Like, it just seems odd that that's kind of where you landed at a median. So I don't know. It's strange to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I wonder if that's reflective a little bit of like the population of people with hypertension. And, you know, I do not know off the top of my head the sort of median age in Alberta, but I wonder how the population.
They're healthier and they develop hypertension later. That's mm-hmm. what we can tell from the way the recruitment went.
Yeah,
or maybe they're
a layup, and this is what you go back at me.
All right. Well, I think we should get to your closing remarks on this, Rahul. So, and I mean, it seems before that, I'm sorry, Paul. Do you as a primary care doctor, can patients just take their blood pressure med whatever time of day they want to, based on what we know so far?
Two thoughts about this. So when the patient is able to take the medication is the time they should take their medication. Like, I think you can't understate the importance of adherence, and more patients are able to take this in the morning than at the nighttime. So I know it obviously didn't affect outcomes that much, but on the other hand, like I am not moved by prior studies. And like I said, I tend to, whenever the patient is able to take it conveniently is the one that I'm leaning towards right now, based on the data that I have. I did want to just kind of circle back just to the putative mechanism here of this sort of non-dipping at nighttime. Like, I know that we did look at obesity and prevalence of sleep apnea, but I don't know how that was actually determined necessarily, because I don't know that going after the nocturnal non-dipping, like, that may not be the mechanisms that's causing the blood pressure itself might not be the mechanisms that cause the elevated cardiovascular risk. Like, is it some function of sleep apnea and the other hemodynamic changes that happen with that, as opposed to just the hypertension component and the non-dipping? Mm-hmm. So mechanistically, I'm still not sure I buy that just lowering the blood pressure at nighttime with a medication is solely sufficient to kind of really impact cardiovascular outcomes.
Yeah, I think you're right to be skeptical of that. I mean, because if there was a big benefit on the order of, you know, what was seen in the Hygieia and MAPEC trials, this study was designed to find them.
Right. But yes.
Okay, Rahul. So what's your hotcakes rating for this one?
All right, team. I know I really rarely tried out the coveted full stack, but I think for me, this is a 5 out of 5.
Wow.
I mean, this was a pragmatic trial, well-designed. You know, they ran out of money, but within the limitations of what they were able to achieve, there was really no signal that there is a finding here that we're missing. So for me, this answers the question, patients can take their medications for blood pressure whenever it makes sense for them. It's safe to do it at night. And, you know, what Nora mentioned about adherence being higher in the morning group at 6 months out, to me, that informs my default recommendation. If patients ask what I recommend, I'll say it's probably easier to stick with it, doing it in the morning. But if you need to do it at night, go ahead. So 5 out of 5.
But Rahul, doesn't it depend on what chronotype you are?
Oh, the chronotype. How could we have neglected the chronotype?
We have neglected it.
What chronotype are you, Nora? Just out of curiosity.
I am definitely, as it was defined in, I think, table one, an early bird. So,
yeah. So the best part of table one is they report the patient's chronotype, and then there's a little superscript, superscript B, and then you go look at superscript B, and it says, chronotype is the time of day that people are more alert and or active. Participants were asked, would you say you are naturally a night owl or an early bird? What a scientific way to determine that. I love it.
I love it so much.
Yeah. Probably most alert during my panic attacks that wake me up from sleep. So what does that, where does that place me?
5 out of 5 right there, Paul. That's great.
All right. Well, Paul, you know, flipping those 5 out of 5 hotcakes might give you some wrist pain. And I believe you're going to tell us about carpal tunnel and how it may or may not be related to rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh, masterful transition. Those cobwebs are shaken off, my friend. So I'm going to be talking about a paper from just this year. It's a population-based study by George et al. In Arthritis Care and Research, which is the Journal of the American College of Rheumatology. And it is carpal tunnel syndrome as an early underrecognized feature of rheumatoid arthritis, a population-based study of carpal tunnel syndrome occurrences before and after rheumatoid arthritis incidents, which is a mouthful. But the question is, what is the occurrence of carpal tunnel syndrome before and after an incidence diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis? And they also looked at serologic status, so whether it was seropositive or seronegative rheumatoid arthritis, how does that impact this diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome? And the reason this is worth caring about is carpal tunnel syndrome we see all the time in primary care, and we see wrist pain all the time in primary care. It's the most common peripheral nerve entrapment syndrome, I think, like a prevalence of like 5%, I think I saw in the paper, which is remarkably high. And it is associated with other stuff like hypothyroidism, like diabetes, and associated also with some chronic inflammation, of which RA is a known cause of. And so their thought is it clinically important to consider rheumatoid arthritis in someone who has a diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome? And then does someone with RA have an increased likelihood to develop carpal tunnel syndrome because of that inflammation? So that's why they're looking at this. And the long and the short of it, the top line answer is that the authors found that, yes, it does seem to matter. So that you are twice as likely, you have a twofold increase in the risk of carpal tunnel syndrome in the years prior to a diagnosis of RA. And you have a 1.8-fold increased risk of developing or being diagnosed, at least, with carpal tunnel syndrome after you're diagnosed with RA. So both leading up to and after the diagnosis, you seem to be at a heightened risk for the development of carpal tunnel syndrome and operative intervention thereof. And that seemed to be even more significant among the so-called seronegative patients. But man, it just squeaked over the line of statistical significance. Like the confidence intervals are like, you know, 0.99 to whatever. So there does seem to be a trend towards seronegativity and this finding, but it's not enough to quite meet statistical significance. So I'll pause there to hear if there are any thoughts or clarifying questions.
I mean, I'm imagining to answer this question, you would need to ensure that you kind of would catch diagnoses of both of these if they were made. So I'm anticipating that, you know, the place where this is done is going to have to support that. So I guess it just brings up the importance of making sure that, like, if the diagnosis had occurred, would you have detected it? So, I mean, you'll tell us about that when we hear about how the study was done and where it was carried out.
I don't have much to say about this other than an anecdote that in a social setting, I don't want to dox the person, but in a social setting in the past year, I encountered a person who was telling me about they had this wrist pain, and then they were tested for rheumatoid arthritis and all these things. The blood work was negative. They went to see a rheumatologist just in case because something seemed off. And it wasn't just your run-of-the-mill carpal tunnel, and it ended up being seronegative rheumatoid arthritis. And, you know, now this is like, I'm like, oh, this person fit a lot of these characteristics that you're talking about.
Yeah, and that was why I was interested in reviewing this, just because we see so much of this, of wrist pain in general. And I think patients are often saddled with a carpal tunnel diagnosis, even in the absence of really a compelling presentation consistent with that. So it sort of raised my antenna, but we can get into that. So let me tell you how they did this, Rahul, since you're nice enough to ask and set me up for that. So this is one of those sort of data mining studies that I am not capable of figuring out. But basically what they did is they used data from the Rochester Epidemiology Project, which is it links data from a number of institutions in the Olmsted and surrounding counties area in Minnesota, and also various EHRs. So it sounds like a heroic accomplishment started in 1966, which I found fascinating, and I'm sure will be continue to be funded robustly
Hell
from
yeah.
today moving forward. But in any case, it has they have this comprehensive database of demographic, medical, social data on over 500,000 individuals that with unique. And the way they actually determined whether the diagnosis of RA was present or not was by ACR criteria through chart mining. they looked at patient data between 1980 and 2019. And the people that were abstracting this data were blinded to the hypothesis. They didn't even know what they were just in there scribbling, like, God bless them. I have to imagine they all developed carpal tunnel syndrome of their own just based on the data abstraction that they were doing. But
torture.
So what they looked at is they looked at patients who had a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis by the 1987 ACR criteria, which I'm sure we all know and love. And these patients were matched one-to-one with patients who did not have RA by age, sex, and the RA incidence, so the index year of the diagnosis of RA. And the patient data was selected between 1980 and 2019. And then they subcategorized the RA patients as seropositive or seronegative based on the presence or absence of rheumatoid factor anti-CCP. And then the carpal tunnel syndrome diagnosis was also done by two ICD-10 codes, or actually just ICD-9 or 10, I believe, if not mistaken, for carpal tunnel syndrome at least 30 days apart. And then the presence or absence of surgery was determined by an actual CPT code, by procedural code. And then they used logistic regression models and descriptive statistics to kind of figure out whether carpal tunnel syndrome happened before the diagnosis or after the diagnosis using, I want to hear Rahul's take on this, they used the development of carpal tunnel syndrome before RA using a case control study design, and they used a cohort study design to see if carpal tunnel happened after the RA diagnosis. So that sort of switch up, Rahul, I was curious as to sort of why they did that or what that even means for me, the reader.
Yeah. Yeah, I had to sit in a dark room thinking about this one for a little while to really untangle everything. But, you know, the basic thing that, you know, our listeners and really all of us should remember about trying to disentangle this is just ask yourself, how were the comparison groups defined? Okay, if the comparison groups are defined by the outcome, then you are very likely dealing with a case control study. Okay, and if the comparison groups are instead defined by an exposure, then it is likely that you're dealing with a cohort study. Okay, so that's a sort of simple rule of thumb that I like to use. I'm sure we can find exceptions to that, but that's sort of the definition. I had to write down what was the independent and the dependent variable for each of these. But basically, the question that they asked about carpal tunnel being diagnosed before rheumatoid arthritis, that's a case control study. And then the question about carpal tunnel being diagnosed after rheumatoid arthritis, that's a cohort study. Okay. And it's kind of important, I think, to also note they weren't really asking a causal question. They were asking, like, is carpal tunnel associated with RA?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's an early manifestation. Maybe RA, you know, in early phases causes this. Maybe they're both caused by some unrelated third thing. So really all this study is trying to evaluate is, are they associated with each other?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's, we learned, Paul, right, that that carpal tunnel is there's some ischemia of the nerve as it's like pinched in the carpal tunnel. So maybe it has to do with inflammation or swelling. And we learned about amyloidosis causing bilateral carpal tunnel, right? But that I think that was more from like extra deposition in the tunnel, maybe, or just nerve damage. I don't know. But
I think nerve infiltration, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one area that I think would be interesting to probe more into in the future, that I think just with the extent of abstraction and data they had, they weren't able to parse out kind of whether there were specific like carpal tunnel phenomena that were more highly related to the risk of RA. And so I think, and bilateral carpal tunnel being one of them that they hypothesized might be. And so I do think that's kind of one area I was thinking, like, mechanistically, you know, are there other specific signs that we should actually be looking for within this kind of broader definition of carpal tunnel?
Yeah, I love that question. I don't know. The abstractor suffered enough, but it would be great to know what the initial symptom was of the carpal tunnel. Was it pain or was it like numbness and paresthesia, which you would expect more with it? And how would that impact outcomes? It would be really interesting to know.
Right. And I mean, this gets back to, I think, what Rahul was saying about like the consistency and quality of the definition of both the exposure and the outcome really drives a lot of kind of how much we can interpret these studies. And I think the definition of RA is quite robust. And then the definition of carpal tunnel with the procedural codes, I think, was made more robust. But I could still see there being some variability in how that was actually coded. So,
yeah, I mean, it kind of enhances. This is a bit of a confusing study to appraise. I'll just start with that because there's, you know, kind of two studies that are being done. But it kind of enhances my acceptance of the conclusion that carpal tunnel is associated with rheumatoid arthritis, which is causal. Like, I'm not really sure from these data. You all might know. But the fact that, you know, when analyzed in different ways, okay, we saw basically the same result. And also we saw that procedural codes for surgery and injections were also more common in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. That's kind of asking about a different outcome in mechanistically related to the diagnosis of carpal tunnel. So we're seeing more than one signal for kind of the same underlying conclusion there. So that all of those things kind of enhance my willingness to accept these findings as true.
So, Paul, what's your conclusion here? Any take-home points? And what's your hotcakes rating?
No, I mean, there was a nice editorial in Journal Watch that, I mean, it was just a sort of brief statement. This should not compel you to just do serologic testing for everyone who presents with carpal tunnel syndrome. But I do think, I was not aware of this as an association, even sort of theoretically before reading this paper. So for someone who presents with wrist pain, I think it's at least good to pause and think, what is it that I'm dealing with here? I think patients are often saddled with carpal tunnel diagnoses just because it's just so common. And even if they don't sort of classically meet the symptoms, you're like, well, their wrist kind of hurts. It's probably carpal tunnel. Here's a brace. Good luck and Godspeed. And I think just to slow down, take a breath, maybe review family history and other symptoms and make sure you're not missing another diagnosis is a good thing to do in general. So I'll give this one a 3 out of 5 because I guess it is a little bit practice changing just from a mindset standpoint. But on the other hand, I would love to see it sort of develop even further still. So 3 out of 5 is what we're going to call it.
Thank you, Paul. And one last thing that we wanted to just go over is that they're an update, really, pertinent to multiple prior shows we've done. As of July 2025, the non-steroidal MRA, that's mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist finerenone, is FDA approved to treat heart failure with an ejection fraction at or above 40%. And this is results based on the Fine Arts HF trial. And Paul, we don't have to go over that one. It's a great name, and I'm sure every letter is accounted for in the name. What do you think?
I think
I'll keep talking. I'll let you look it up.
Probably pulled like the fine from the finerenone. I don't know. I'd have to go back and sort of dissect it. It's better than the iron one.
But basically, it reduced the number of worsening heart failure events in that trial convincingly, which was defined as a first or recurrent unplanned hospitalization for urgent visit for heart failure. It did not reduce cardiovascular death in that study, and it has previously been FDA approved for managing patients with CKD and diabetes. We talked about this with Joel Toff on the CKD, managing diabetes and high blood pressure in CKD. We mentioned finerenone, and at the time it was not yet approved. And about just recently, he emailed me and said, hey, you guys just reran that episode. That's no longer true. Did you see that finerenone is now FDA approved for heart failure? So that kind of brought my attention to it. That's why I wanted to bring it up on the show. So we've updated those show notes, but I wanted to make sure people were aware of it. And we also recorded with Dr. Kittleson last year, Paul, and the great Dr. Michelle Kittleson. I emailed her as well, and she got right back to me. Just these great guests, her and Tom, are great guests, just keep giving back to us. They both got back to me within like an hour. She said, I'm glad you asked. She said she believes that the TOPCAT trial, which was this famous trial of spironolactone in heart failure with preserved EF, where they actually went back and looked for like metabolites of spironolactone, and they looked for potassium changes that they would expect to see. And they saw those in the United States sites and some of the Eastern European sites, they did not see those. So there was question about adherence in the study and validity of the data, and they think maybe that kind of diluted it and led to that being a negative trial. So it's sort of been like a low-key treatment, spironolactone, for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And I asked her, do we think that this is a class effect, meaning like because finerenone had a positive trial, are we also going to grandfather in spironolactone? And she said, I'm glad you asked. And she said, based on the TOPCAT trial, even though the subgroup analysis are inherently hypothesis generating, she says she considers the Fine Arts trial to be vindication of the TOPCAT trial. And she said that, I know the authors tout finerenone's unique benefits as a non-steroidal MRA with balanced heart and kidney distribution, but she considers that a little bit of hand-waving, pathophysiologic rationalization, and ultimately, perfect is the enemy of good. If cost is not a problem, it's fine to follow the perfect evidence base and prescribe finerenone, but if cost is a problem, give the perfectly good option of spironolactone. So... thank you to Dr. Kittleson. She is fantastic. And
the best.
Bottom line, I think, is if you need it, you know, both these agents, spironolactone and finerenone, are on the table for your patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. Comments, questions from anybody?
I'm just wondering, Matt. So, I mean, the FDA approval is great. What do the guidelines say currently about, like, the strength of evidence, and is this something we should be giving patients with HFpEF?
Yeah, Rahul. So this I believe is a 2B, so it's like a weaker recommendation currently, but that was before the Fine Arts trial results had been out. So in prior conversations with Dr. Kittleson, she gave me the impression she thinks it's going to be upgraded. Maybe it'll be a 2A, or maybe, I don't know if it'll be a level one recommendation, but I think we'll see that recommendation be upgraded. And I think, you know, right now, I think you'd be well within your rights to start prescribing this for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction if you wanted to. So, you know, for me and the right patient, I think, I think it's definitely on the table right now. I don't know, Paul, do you feel the same, or?
Yeah, no, I have nothing to argue with, man.
I was like, I'm done. It's fine.
No, I'm so excited to finally be able to prescribe finerenone. I've been having, like, just at the ready, script hand on paper.
Yeah, and I haven't prescribed it yet, mainly for cost. I mean, spironolactone, yeah. And, you know, I'm comfortable using that one or a eplerenone. So, but I mean, it's just a matter of time, Paul. You gotta, at some point, you're going to pull the trigger.
I know. I never want to embrace the future, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, Oliver's behind you on your chair, probably begging for food. You probably haven't eaten dinner yet, so we should probably get to an outro. I think we've done great work. Everyone, great work tonight. So thank you.
Sure thing, Matt. This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
It's about right. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes the Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and we want your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. Also, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. I wanted to give a special thanks to our writers and producers for this episode, Dr. Rahul Ganatra, Dr. Nora Toronto, and Dr. Paul Williams. And to our whole Curbsiders team, our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Waddle runs our Patreon. Krista Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Waddle.
I've been Dr. Rahul Ganatra.
I've been Dr. Nora Toronto.
And as always, I mean Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.
So support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.